The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program,
this warhorse was quickly into the thick of things. The horse the Germans could not kill.
The real warhorses of World War I. Also,
according to this repeated nationwide survey, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette.
The not-so-distant days when cigarettes were endorsed by doctors and athletes. And we'll also be talking about filmmaking here 100 years ago and the exploits of forgotten aviator Hubert Latham. We begin this evening with the horses of World War I, brought to life most famously by Michael Morpurgo in his novel, play and film War Horse. His story was inspired by a family heirloom, as we hear now.
At the beginning of War Horse, it really started with the discovery that we had four pictures, watercolour pictures, done by a man called F.W. Reed during the First World War for the Illustrated London News, and they were contemporary pictures of British cavalry charging during the First World War. And one particular picture was of horses being caught up in barbed wire as they charged a German position. I wanted this to be the story of the First World War, the story of the universal suffering during that war on all sides and by civilians who were in the middle of it all. And I knew in my heart the right way to do that was to tell the story from the horse's point of view.
Well, opinions differ among those who saw War Horse as to where facts meet fairy tale, but one is thing for certain. Historical records show that 8 million horses were killed on all sides during the First World War. 9 million men and women, 8 million horses. I'm joined by Stephen Benedict, author of Passchendaele, a novel set during the Great War. He's here to talk about the role of horses and indeed other animals in this war. We'll start with the horses. War broke out in August 1914. The British Army had 25,000 horses. How many did they reckon they needed?
Another 500,000. And so what they did was they just went across the countryside in the shires and they commandeered all the horses and ponies and mules available. And the thing was, you know, what was happening obviously very early in those days was Britain was putting itself on a war footing and the countryside was simply arable. It was there for agriculture. And suddenly these horses who had been reared and trained for helping on the farm suddenly had to were transported into war situations. So they were hoisted onto ships and brought across the channel. It wasn't only happening in Britain. Britain contacted the United States and they requested the United States get involved and help. And the United States were shipping over 1,000 horses a day from 1914, which is quite interesting because America officially was neutral and it didn't get involved in the war until 1917. But of 1,000 horses a day, when we were talking about 7,000 a week, 31,000 a month, 365,000 a year for 3 years. And so what was happening then was that the horses were expected initially to take part in cavalry charges. But the last great cavalry charge took place in Mons of August 1914.
I mean, the war had barely started before the cavalry were essentially out of the equation.
That's right. I mean, the British Expeditionary Force arrived, tried to defend France. The Germans had come sweeping down through Belgium. And quickly after that, it descended into trench warfare. So what do you do with all these horses? Well, you use them to transport military equipment. You use them to transport things up and down the line. And also then you're expecting them to partake in rescue missions and all sorts of dreadful things. And as you said, it wasn't only the horses were killed, they would have died in gas attacks, and then they would drown in mud. The most appalling deaths imaginable to man and beast, because it wasn't only just gunshots that would see off the animal, but dreadful situations going on.
And whereas a man might be able to see an attack coming, he'll see a machine gun, he'll hear a shell, and he would be able to duck and cover or whatever, the horse would not necessarily be in the same position.
Well,
they were more exposed.
The men knew what was happening, the horses didn't. Yeah.
There are many stories, there are many poems about the loyalty that developed between horse and mules. Let's not forget mules, because there were lots of them as well, and man over the course of the war. Tell me about the donkey called Jimmy the Sergeant.
Jimmy the Sergeant. That dates to the Battle of the Somme in 1916. And Jimmy became a mascot for the British troops. He was wounded no less than 3 times. And that was over the course of 2 years. And it'll give you the indication as to the suffering that the horses went through, because they weren't given leave. They couldn't go home. And so he was taught to raise his hoof by the soldiers who bought him up.
In a salute?
Well, he would raise. He was basically stomping. And he became a source of great inspiration after the war. His presence in Britain, in Peterborough, raised thousands of pounds for the charity of the RSPCA. And then he was posthumously awarded the what's called the Dickon Medal for Bravery, which is the high, and people may laugh, but this is the highest military honour afforded to an animal. And he was made a sergeant, of which, as far as I'm aware, he outranked many of the men who would have commanded him during the war, which I think is a nice piece of irony.
And there was also Duffy the Donkey. And what can you tell me about Duffy the Donkey?
Duffy the Donkey, that story dates from Gallipoli. And what he did was he transported injured soldiers. And the thing is, you've got to remember, you know, Gallipoli was fought in a very, very narrow terrain between the sea front or the shoreline and the hill. And so when men were being slaughtered left, right and centre, Duffy the Donkey was sent in to bring back the injured men. And as far as I'm aware, when they were withdrawing, when the British were withdrawing from Gallipoli, they were forced to leave behind over 500 mules. And I think rather than leave them to the Turks, what happened?
They were essentially shot.
They were all shot.
The mules were shot. Now, one famous British war horse, Warrior, became known as the horse the Germans couldn't kill, as we hear now from James Keating.
When Warrior first entered the Great War in 1914, the conflict was expected to be fought across the open fields of France and Belgium. Within months, opposing sides were fighting from trenches for every inch of ground. War horses didn't suit this kind of battle. But Warrior didn't leave the fight. Owned by General Jack Seeley, this war horse was quickly into the thick of things. By 1915, Warrior had narrowly avoided capture and survived being shot at and shelled. Promotion was in order for him and General Seeley. They took command of the Canadian Cavalry. The Canadian Cavalry were a motley bunch of ranchers, Mounties and Native Americans. Seeley and Warrior would lead them in battles across the front line over the next 2 years. Warrior became a hero, and in 1918, as the Germans mounted their spring offensive, he would face his greatest challenge. At Morale Wood in France, Warrior stood at the head of the cavalry. The Germans were advancing westward rapidly. Stopping them was crucial. A line was drawn at the Avre River. Warrior rode out, followed by 11 other horses. The plan was for General Seeley to plant a red pennant at the top of the hill above the river. The pennant would guide the rest of the cavalry into battle. As soon as the pennant is planted, chaos erupts. The cavalry charges. Horses are mown down by machine gun fire. Shells fall around them. Men thrown from their mounts fight with pistol and blade. Warrior, amazing, stays in the battle. Soon the Germans are forced back. As light fades, Morale Wood belongs to the Canadian Cavalry. The German advance is halted. It's a massive turning point in the war. Shortly after the battle, an injury forced Warrior out of the war. It's remarkable he survived it all. Of 1 million horses sent to France, only 62,000 returned home. Only one of them, upon his death in 1941, had an obituary which read, "The horse the Germans could not kill."
An amazing story of courage and heroism told there by James Keating. Now, Canada also has its own celebrated war horse with the unlikely name of Bunny. He was the only survivor of 18 horses that were sent to the Great War. Tell me about Bunny the Horse.
Bunny the Horse, as you say, originates in Canada and was packed off as part of the Canadian Expeditionary Force, and his first engagement, Bunny's first engagement, comes in April of 1915, April the 22nd to be precise. April of 1915 saw the Second Battle of Ypres, and it was the first known deployment of gas on the Western Front. And so poor old Bunny was exposed to the gas. Sergeant Major Tom Dundas, who was Canadian, was riding the horse by the end of the war. The thing was that his younger brother had been riding Bunny during the war, and his brother had been killed. So it's quite unusual for the horse to be requested and then to come into the ownership or the possession of a same member of the family. And then what happened was, at the end of the war, Dundas was then demobbed and went back to Canada. But all the horses were left in Europe. And tragically and quite savagely, they ended up as horse meat because the Allies simply couldn't be bothered sending out another ship to bring all these horses back. But Dundas then tried to have Bunny returned, only to discover that Bunny had been sold for the princely sum of £40 to the Belgians. But it just gives you an indication as to the degree to which there was a bonding between the men and the horses.
Now, 8 million horses, donkeys and mules died on all sides from exhaustion, starvation, drowning in mud, being blown up, being shot, whatever it might happen to be.
But it's interesting, it's not until 2004 that an animal war memorial is erected in Hyde Park, and the inscription reads, "Animals in war, this monument is dedicated to all the animals that served and died alongside British and Allied forces in wars and campaigns throughout the time. They had no choice." That's the important line to put into context here, because people volunteered, they can be conscripted, but they know what they're getting into. These poor animals had no idea what they were being headed sent off for.
Thousands of dogs were also involved in World War One. Do we have any idea how many, and in what kind of capacity?
Well, the best dogs, shall we say, the Doberman pincers and German Shepherd dogs. And I think the Germans had about 30,000 of them. And the British had a similar number than the Italians.
Presumably the British couldn't trust German Shepherd dogs.
They didn't speak the language. Ah. That was the problem. But the thing is, they're deployed in a variety of different roles depending on size and intelligence. Now, the thing is, people say the animals are intuitive. Yes, but they can be trained. And so generally the dogs fell into different categories of sentry dogs, scout dogs, casualty dogs, where they go off into no man's land and to retrieve and to tend to men who are injured, messenger dogs, believe this, explosive dogs, which is very frightening to think of, and of course mascots. But the thing that I find most objectionable is explosive dogs.
Yeah. So they basically would strap bombs to them and send
that's
them
precisely to it.
The trenches. Tell me about Sergeant Stubby.
Well, this is quite funny. He was a stray pup. Okay, from Yale University, and he was assisting the 102nd Infantry Regiment in their training. Now that he was basically a mix of a pit bull, and he was a source of great amusement to the men in the regiment. And then he was adopted, strange enough, by a private J. Robert Conroy, who then smuggled him across the French to the lines in France. Now, the thing was, in his first engagement, I think Stubby was again exposed to mustard gas, and he became highly sensitized to the noxious fumes, and that assisted the soldiers greatly in anticipating the gas that may have been coming across the line.
He became a kind of a canary in the coal mine, as
indeed, yeah. Yes. And what he did was, one day he actually spotted a German spy and attacked him until the reinforcements arrived.
And he was promoted.
He was. Now, this is really, really funny. He was made a sergeant. So if you excuse the pun, you have the sergeant barking orders. Okay.
Oh,
so the amazing thing, though, the thing was, Miles, he survived 17 battles and several wounds. And then he returned to the United States as a war hero.
But it's important to remember he outranked Robert Conroy.
He did. Who only made it to the level of corporal. So, I mean, who are you going to listen to? None of your lip, Corporal Conroy.
Now, very importantly, communications were a huge problem during the war.
Yeah.
Telephony was in its infancy. So pigeons played a very important role, didn't
they? I know, amazingly. I mean, we'll come to this in a second, for a pigeon called Cher Ami. But if you think about it, you know, your communication lines could be cut. Okay, and so you could be cut off. And what would happen if your soldiers got so far behind enemy lines that they themselves could be cut off? And that's what happened. There's a group of American soldiers, almost 200 of them, and they were cut off, believe it or not, 25 miles behind German lines, and they couldn't ferry the messages back.
I point out to anybody, is much later in the war. This is October 1918, when there was actually rapid movement. The idea of being caught 25 miles behind the trenches is just ridiculous.
Yes, I mean, the incursion had been so
plausible
successful.
In 1918.
Yeah, and so what they did was they dispatched this pigeon called Cher Ami, and he flew 25 miles in 25 minutes. Okay, this guy was, you know, not exactly hitting the speed of sound, but he's 60 miles an hour. And he was shot on the way back, and he survived. And by delivering the message, 200 soldiers were saved. But the thing was, it was an amazing act of marksmanship by the German soldier who shot him. Because if you think about trying to shoot down a pigeon flying that fast, so what both sides did was they employed falcons to attack and to hunt down and to go after the pigeons themselves. And actually, it was a much more successful route of intercepting the messages than trying to shoot the pigeons down themselves.
And we hasten to add that Cheremy was awarded the Croix de Guerre for his exploits. The British Army put something like, was it 500,000 cats to work? Doing what?
Gas detectors. But if you think about it also, that there were de-stressors. If you're sitting in the trenches for a long time, and people will know this if they have pets at home themselves, just to be there with the cat or the dog in your lap and just stroking the cat and the dog, it gives great comfort and relief to anybody living at home. But can you imagine just the de-stressor, that reality in the trenches for those men? So again, they're mascots. But it was also a means by which the soldiers could focus on something for affection.
And keep the rat population.
Well, that was a big, ratter. So that was a big one.
Okay, finally, tell me about the most unlikely non-human companions in the World War One trenches.
I'll resort to my Latin, and I'll ask for people to forgive me if I mispronounce this, but it's Lampyrus Noctiluca.
Okay, there aren't any ancient Romans around, so nobody's going to have a go at you.
It's not Romans, go home. They're glowworms, okay? It sounds crazy, but if you were to gather about 10 glowworms and put them in a jar, there'd be sufficient light to actually read messages. And so instead of having very, very powerful lamps, which could actually give away your position to the enemy, they would know that you're up at the parapet, but you could sit down in the depth of the trench with these glowworms, and they had hundreds of thousands of them, that they would literally just dig out of the earth and pop them in these jars, and they were able to light the trenches during the evening time for the soldiers to read messages at crucial times.
Right, okay. You could write your memoirs to a glow or to 10 glowworms.
Diaries, yes. You wonder how much poetry was written by glowworm
life. Precisely, Mr. Sassoon and Mr. Owen. And Stephen Benedict's novel, Passchendaele, which is set in the days leading up to, during and after the Great War, is available from Amazon.com. Details on our website. And the stage adaptation of War Horse opens this Wednesday at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. After the break, we'll be hearing about an American film company who came here more than 100 years ago to make the first fictional film outside the United States of America. Welcome back. Now to a trailblazing American film company who made the first ever fiction film outside the USA, right here in Ireland. They returned several times and were exotic local celebrities in Cork and Kerry.
Well, here we are back in dear old Ireland, and it really seemed like coming back home. So many dear familiar spots, so many friendly faces. Even the dog, Brandy, and Blackjack, the favorite horse, were glad to see us. As for the people, from the Gap of Dunloe to Killarney, we are greeted in quaint Irish terms of welcome. And women and children run to the cottage doors to wave to us as we go by.
Between 1910 and 1915, the Calum Company made almost 30 films here, dealing with, among other things, Irish history and emigration. We'll be hearing later about their 1914 film Come Back to Erin, which is now available on the Century Ireland website. But first, to hear about the Calums and their incredible work here, I'm joined by Suniva O'Flynn of the Irish Film Institute, and from our Galway studio by Tony Tracy, lecturer with the Houston School of Film and Digital Media at NUI Galway. You're both very welcome indeed. Tony, first of all, tell us, who were the Calums?
Well, the Calums was a company that was born out of a rather tumultuous period, around 1907. And early silent film history is quite interesting because you can actually see very distinct differences between each of the particular years. And around 1907, you have a very, very large change in the way American film is being produced and distributed. And if you could reduce that to one single reason, it was the birth of the Nickelodeon. So in other words, we have the end of the travelling projectionist and slideshow talker, although they exist for a bit longer, but a move towards what we now know as cinemas and a move towards story films. So in 1906, 1905, 1906, this begins to happen. And you have, as a consequence, a demand for more story films. And as a consequence of that, you have the birth of a number of different film companies. And one of those film companies, one of the pioneering ones, is the Calum Film Company. So these are kind of the precursors of film studios today. It's made up of a guy called George Kleine, Samuel Long, and Frank Marion, K-L-M. So they make that into a word and call it Calum. Kleine owned what was called a film exchange in Chicago, and he became a producer because they were no longer selling films, they were renting them. And the other two had worked for Biograph, which was the biggest film production company of the time, and home, of course, famously to D.W. Griffith. And they formed this company, and the two first people they hired was an actor-director called Sidney Olcott and a writer-actress called Jean Gontier. And it's important to say that you can tell that I've given them a number of jobs there because that's how it was. They were a sort of on-the-road, multitasking kind of film unit. So the roles of film were not as clear as they are today.
And they were affectionately known as the O'Calums. What made them to decide to come to Ireland and make so many films?
So they called themselves the O'Calums because they published this little catalogue, the Calum Calendar, that came out once in a while. Now, why did they come to Ireland? And this is something I've often thought about. You get in Jean Gontier's memoir an excuse, an explanation that the director of the company, Frank Marion, suggested it. You get somewhere else, somebody suggests that they put a pin in a map and they suggested it. But I think probably the most acceptable explanation is simply that the boat, that they went off to film locations in Europe and the boat stopped in Cove. I think it just that was the first place they stopped and they said, Ireland, we'll get off there. Why would they get off there? Well, A, because there would be a very large Irish-American audience who would be keen to have pictures of the homeland in the United States and in New York in particular where they were. And secondly, because Ireland as a kind of an imaginary space was very well known in those eastern cities through songs and popular culture and particularly, and this is very important, through the drama of Dion Boucicault.
Now, they made history by producing not only the earliest series of fiction films made in Ireland, but also the first films to be shot on both sides of the Atlantic.
So what was interesting and daring about the Calum Film Company was that they decided that their brand identity, if you want to put it that way, rather like, say, MGM made a lot of musicals in the 50s, they decided what they would be best known for is shooting locations. They would be known for their capturing of genuine and authentic locations. So what they did was they shot their very first film, The Lad from Old Ireland, the first Irish film. They'd been in existence about 2 years at this point. And they shot it on the ferry, on the boat on the way over, and they made up a little simple scenario. They had a crew, and this is extraordinary to think of. They had a crew of three people. They had the director, Olcott. They had the scenario writer, and they had the cameraman, Hollister. So it was a very, very tight crew. And they shot it on the boat on the way over. They shot some of the scenes in New York Harbour, and then they shot the rest of it in the fields around Cove and Cork.
Now, what else was going on, Suniva, in terms of the shooting of films and perhaps even the exhibition of films in Ireland at around that time, 1910?
Yeah, I think it might begin to answer the question as well, why did they come to Ireland? Kerry and Irish people in 1910, there were no strangers to film cameras. I mean, there had been a small amount of Indigenous activity, but quite a number of foreign film companies had been in Ireland from about 1897 to 1910. So we had the Lumiere brothers coming in 1897. We had the Warwick Film Company, the Gaumont Company, Pathé. They'd all been to Ireland, documenting the beauties of the Irish landscape. These little films went into film catalogues and were distributed around the world to show off Ireland as a beautiful beauty spot, but also for educational and entertainment purposes. So Kerry itself, of course, was quite the tourist destination by 1910, 1911. Queen Victoria had visited some years before. So I think the fact that they came to Kerry where there was a railway line, where it was relatively sophisticated for producers to come in, is probably not terribly surprising. And of course, it was where the liners landed in Queenstown.
Tony, tell us a little bit more about the first movie, The Lad from Old Ireland. It's the silent movie era. So what was the plot? How carefully planned or made out in advance would it have been? Or was it all kind of worked out along the way?
The first Hollywood feature film was made in 1914. So in 1910, we still have very short one-reel films. And during the period of 1910 to 1914, when the Calums are in Ireland, they move progressively from one-reel, about 5 minutes, to three-reel, to about 15-minute or 20-minute length films. So they're developing, and the stories are developing as the history of film, if you like, is developing. This first story, The Lad from Old Ireland, is really beautiful and extremely touching and extremely effective, even to this day. And as you suggest, I think some of it was made up, on the hoof. There's a sense of opportunism, certainly in use of locations. But it's simply about a guy who gets bored, if you like, in the rural countryside, decides to go to the promised land, that is America, reflects, I guess, Irish-American history in that sense. He gets there, he gets distracted, he meets beautiful society women, he achieves social mobility, he becomes some kind of local politician. And then there's a note saying, please come home. He comes home and he's reunited with his sweetheart. So it's a story, I guess, that plays to the anxieties of the immigrant about the abandonment of home. And it has this great sort of romantic notion of home. And one of the things that's extremely striking about The Lad from Old Ireland is that it really prefigures The Quiet Man and the narrative of return that takes off in the post-war period again.
But Sunniva, it's a film, and this was also true of the other work of the Caelums, it abandons or forswears, if you like, the normal Irish stereotype. These are more films about real Irish people as opposed to stage Irish people.
They are. I think what's interesting about a lot of these films is their incorporation of Irish activities, whether it's people at work or peasants going about their business with livestock and so on. And we see it in Lad from Old Ireland, where not only are the Caelum actors doing their thing, but they bring in the locals to act as well. So we see them in their regular clothes doing their regular activities. And this is revisited then throughout the Caelum cycle. In Come Back to Ireland particularly, there's wonderful actuality footage of a cattle fair in Kerry, and there's departure from Queenstown. So there's these moments of Irish social history that happen to be captured within these fiction films.
Prefiguring Flaherty by about 30 years.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm, and
extraordinary.
They almost feel, at moments, they feel like documentary, because here you have a camera with actors moving in and out of frame, but in among the real life situations. So they're very rich for that.
Now, after their success with The Lad from Old Ireland, Olcott and Gontier returned to Ireland in the summer of 1911. In this extract from her 1928 memoir, Jean Gontier recalls socialising with the locals in Kerry after a day's work.
Often at night in the old tavern, sitting in the dim light of the peat fire, we would listen to tales of persecutions and evictions, of the battering ram and the cottage set on fire, and to ravings at the tyranny of England. And although we later learned to allow for Irish imagination, and to take all such horrors with a grain of salt, it was well for the kind of pictures upon which we were engaged that our sympathies were so aroused, for it lent conviction to our portrayals.
Now, Tony, on this second trip, they had more time, they brought more of their own resources, if you like, over with them in terms of cast and crew. They set up base in Kerry, they made 18 films, which sounds astonishing. Okay, they weren't feature-length films. What kind of stories and themes were they tackling in 1911?
Yeah, and it's probably important to say that when they came back the second time, and the story around this is a little bit apocryphal, I'm not sure of its veracity or not, but they certainly moved further inland. And as Sunniva has suggested, they would have definitely been drawn to Killarney because it would have been world famous in terms of visual representations already, and also in terms of the plays of Boucicault and so on and so forth. But they went actually slightly beyond Killarney to Beaufort, to the O'Sullivan family's tavern in Beaufort, just beyond Killarney. The story that's in the family of the O'Sullivans, whose tavern is still there, is that they were picked up by a cab driver who was a regular at the pub. I don't know how true that is, but it's a nice story. And this brought them into even a more remote environment. And the saliency of that particular detail is that they became very, very embedded, to use a contemporary term, within the community. They lost the tourist gaze pretty quickly, although they did, as Sunniva suggested, take advantage of the Tork waterfall and the lakes of Killarney and so on and so forth. And the reason why I'm saying that is that the stories, we began to see the stories become a little bit more politicised, a little bit less dependent, if you like, on stereotypes, or even just the stereotype of the immigrant, which was, I have to say, rather freshly treated in the first film. So we do end up moving into stories like Rory O'Moore and their interest in the 1798 rebellion, of which they made about four or five films, their adaptation of the smash hit, Broadway smash hit, The Colleen Bawn by Boucicault, and a few kind of, as Sunniva suggests, sort of documentaries. So there's a Corpus Christi procession, which is no longer there, Aaron the Pogue, and a few other things like that. And an adaptation of You Remember Ellen from Moore's Melody. So a wide wide variety of material, I would say.
And then Gontier and Olcott essentially detach themselves from the Calum Film Company, form their own company, the Jean Gontier Feature Players. But they come back to Ireland for at least one or two more years?
Yeah, because this is a little bit sketchy, but they it's important to say that at the end of every one of these trips, they went on to Europe to film a bit more. So they went to Egypt, they filmed the pyramids, and they set a story there. They were called the El Calums in Egypt. They went to Palestine and made the first biblical story, From the Manger to the Cross. I know there's a copy of that in the Irish Film Archive. And that was the first adaptation of the Christ story, which has a very bizarre ending where Jesus isn't resurrected. And there was some kind of row between Olcott and Marion. Olcott said he wanted more money, basically. He was a star kind of... And they used to travel for months on end. I mean, it was quite a weird sort of setup. They'd send back the film little by little without having seen it developed. And there was some kind of row and they split and they set up the GGs, the Jean Gontier Players. And Olcott became the director and she maintained her status as the star. And what you begin seeing those last couple of years is they remake some of the 1798 narratives, which they're absolutely compelled by. And these 1798 narratives become ever more political, ever more politicised. And there's a controversy around disturbing the peace, so to speak, in Killarney with the sort of nationalist rhetoric that's been sent over to the United States. And these films become more elaborate, both in terms of narrative and in terms of style.
And they actually had a film made about Robert Emmet, which was banned by the British government in 1914.
Yeah, that's right. So that's exactly what I'm saying. And it is interesting, of course, that in 14, in the lead up to, we're in the middle of that now, that these were the stories that they were pointing to. And those stories, of course, would sort of fade a little bit after 16.
Now, in this extract from her memoirs, Jean Gontier writes about leaving Ireland for the last time.
It was a wrench leaving our lovely surroundings. For Ireland has a way of creeping into the heart and twining itself there with tendrils, which can never be completely uprooted. We had been very happy and had sent back the finest pictures Calum had ever done, taken as they were under such ideal circumstances. And while we had hopes in the beginning of a return the next summer, these now seemed doomed to disappointment. For our company was held together by the compelling personality of Sidney Olcott, and he had announced to us that he was leaving the Calum Company and pictures for good, to enter business. I do not know what Calum will do without Sid, or what we will do. I know my own work will suffer. It is because we work so well together, and I believe neither of us would do well alone. That often happens to people who have risen together.
Sidney, 30 or so films made. How many of them survive today, and in what state? Are they complete or are they incomplete?
Well, the films from this period, of course, Miles, would have been made and distributed on 35mm nitrate stock, which, as we all know, is
dangerous.
Very dangerous and unstable. And if it isn't found and preserved, it will just disappear. So many, many of the films have just disappeared. Now, we haven't given up hope, but the fact is that we have just identified 8 of the films that we have brought together in the Irish Film Archive from various archives around the world, and we have restored them and made them now available on DVD. And in fact, the print of Lad from Old Ireland, we first encountered it with German intertitles because it had been preserved by an abbé Joie, an educationalist in the Swiss Alps, I think, who had found copies of films that he understood even back in the early 20s and 30s that they needed to be centralised and preserved. So, there was a pocket of films that had been preserved and we were able to retrieve and repatriate.
And Tony, Come Home to Erin is now available on the Century Ireland website. It was made in 1914. So what is this one about, finally?
There's only one reel out of these three reels left. It's made in 1914, so it's coming towards the end of their period. And it's one of their two great subjects, along with Robert Emmet and 1798. This is their other great subject, which is The Emigrant. And this one is reversed of The Lad from Old Ireland. It's The Girl from Old Ireland, and she goes over. So it's an adaptation on what they were good at. And in a sense, and as Sunita said, one of the striking things is this kind of... pan that goes across this cattle fair, and I don't know if it's been identified as Killarney or whatever, but it certainly would be around Darragh Cove. But it, so there's a greater element of documentary in it for sure. But it plays to this this narrative that they had used several times before, which is this transatlantic passage.
Sunniva O'Flynn and Tony Tracy, many thanks for joining me this evening. You can find details of Come Home to Erin and further information about this item on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. By the way, 100 years ago this month, the Lord Mayor of Dublin gave the go-ahead for cinemas to be open on Sundays, providing it wasn't during mass times. He said that the working people of the cities would be better off under strict supervision at the cinema rather than be parading through some of the principal thoroughfares cheek by jowl with the army. So there you are. After the break, we'll be hearing about a forgotten aviator and a time not so long ago when cigarettes were endorsed by doctors and sports people. 10 years ago this week, we were the first country in the world to impose an outright ban on smoking in the workplace. It's been so successful that these days most people wouldn't dream of lighting up inside, even in their own homes. But let's roll back the clock a few decades to a time when cigarettes were being endorsed by athletes and doctors as part of a campaign which featured what is perhaps one of the world's first publicity stunts. So outrageous were the campaign's claims at the time, they could actually be considered quite comic now, as Louise Denver reports.
I'm going to Charleston, back to my old shack in Charleston, Charleston. Hang my head up on the rack in Charleston, Charleston.
In mid-1920s America, women had won the right to vote and there were more opportunities in the workforce than ever before. But there were still many things that didn't conform to the perceived constructs of femininity at the time, and cigarettes were one of them.
It was simply socially frowned upon for women to be seen smoking in public, and as a consequence, many public places like stores and restaurants would ban women from smoking inside them.
But this discrimination was soon to end, and according to media consultant Paul Anderson, this was thanks in part to one of the grandfathers of public relations, a contractor of Lucky Strike cigarettes, Edward Bernays.
He was a nephew of Sigmund Freud, and one of the things he did was he contacted a psychoanalyst called Brill and said to him, can you look into what it is that cigarettes mean to women? Because they're a huge untapped market, and his job was to try to develop that market. So Brill came up with this term. He said they are torches of freedom to women because they represent something that makes them effectively equal to males. So in the case of cigarettes, it liberates you, it makes you equal to men.
And that was just the message. What Bernays did next was what could be called one of the world's first publicity stunts.
He invited all the media down to Fifth Avenue and he placed them strategically at certain points. And then he hired several debutantes, as they were called at the time, who were basically, if you like, the young women of the bourgeois. And he encouraged them to walk up and down on this Easter parade on a Saturday. And at a certain point where the media were gathered, they all produced their cigarettes and started smoking and declared these to be torches of freedom. The phrase caught on. It was right across the national media within a couple of days, and in cities all across America, women started lighting up immediately. And within less than a decade, it actually went up by almost double.
When it came down to it, though, bosses at Lucky Strike felt that the Torches of Freedom campaign simply didn't generate enough revenue for Lucky Strike in particular, so Bernays came up with a rather innovative solution.
When the same man from Lucky Strike's Hill came to Bernays, he said to him, look, we're not selling enough of our cigarettes. You've done a great job in getting women to smoke, but they're smoking all sorts of brands. So he did a very early example of market research when he pulled together lots of women and basically asked them, you know, why don't you smoke these cigarettes? And the most common answer he got was they didn't like the colour of the packaging. It was a dark green.
So I said to Mr. Hill, why don't you change the colour of the package? And he said to me, I'm spending $65 million a year to popularise green. So I was rather young at that time, and I said, well, then let's change the colour of the fashion.
And that's exactly what he did. And again, using the integrated marketing technique, he went to a famous patron of the Women's Infirmary in New York and said to her, I'll give you $25,000 if you organise a big bash, a big event that the media will be attracted to, but you must promote the colour green. So it was called the Green Ball, and it was modelled on the big fashion event of the year in Paris. And he actually got couturiers to design green garments for everyone who attended the ball. Even the food was green at the ball, but everything at the Waldorf Astoria where the ball was held was in green. And true enough, his event got a huge amount of publicity, and by the time Christmas had come around, green was in effect the new black. It was the colour of the season.
I went to a newsstand to get a paper, and there I noticed a copy of Harper's Bazaar and Vogue with women in green on the cover. Green became a fashionable color.
Light up the lucky.
It's light up time.
Be happy, go lucky.
It's light up time.
Bernays's Torches of Freedom campaign and the Green Ball were wildly successful together, but there was a lot more to come. They eventually became part of a much larger integrated marketing campaign.
An expert endorsement in particular is another one of his pioneering steps. And this is when we can see what now look like very, very funny adverts, which was that your doctor advises you to smoke a particular brand.
Coffee, doctor?
Oh, fine. Have a Camel with your coffee.
Thanks.
According to this repeated nationwide survey, more doctors smoke Camels than any other cigarette. See how Camels agree with your throat. See how mild and good tasting a cigarette can be.
All of these things coming together to promote cigarettes, PR techniques to support advertising techniques, which were informed by market research techniques, which were informed by psychoanalysis. All of these things coming together to promote cigarettes, and cigarette firms have been doing this type of thing ever since. He's the ultimate spin doctor.
I'm gonna Charleston, back to my old shack in Charleston, Charleston. Hang my head up on the rack in Charleston, Charleston. I'm so full of joy today.
Louise Denver reporting there on what could be called one of the world's first integrated marketing campaigns, and a time that's been relegated to ancient history. Now, speaking of cigarettes and their bygone appeal, here's an adventurer whose smoking was vital to his image as a cool, laid-back hero. Hubert Latham received public acclaim as one of the brightest stars of aviation in the early 1900s, but nowadays his name means very little to most people. For his story of heroic endeavour, I'm joined by historian Dr. Barbara Walsh, who recently brought out a book on his life and untimely death. Now, Hubert Latham, Barbara, he was wealthy, he was charming, he was good-looking, he was a traveller, a sportsman, an aviator, but tell us a little bit more about his background. Who was he?
The Latham, or Latham as it's called in French, were an English family, probably came over with the Normans, but had gone back to France and set up as mercantile traders. And on the mother's side of the family, there were bankers to the royal family, in fact, you know, very top class people. He spoke English accentless, he went to Oxford. He also spoke perfect German. And there was a grand aunt who was the mother of the German Chancellor. Now, all these factors came to play when he became to be puffed as the perfect man to be the first man to fly the English Channel.
Okay. Now but there's a story attached to that. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. But before he flew the English Channel in a plane, in 1905, he made his mark, I suppose, in aviation with a record-breaking balloon trip across the Channel. Tell us about that.
That's right, yes. It was with a cousin of his. I mean, they were all interrelated, these people. Cousin of his made the fastest balloon from England, from the Crystal Palace, landing outside Paris. And he became famous, and all the salons in Paris were open to him.
His next achievement was to win prizes as helmsman of a motor launch Monaco Regatta.
That's right. See, I think he was a young man at those days, you know, fast cars and fast women. And he was asked, would he pilot this Antoinette engine, which was being experimented on, and he won prizes in Monaco. And the same engine then was starting to be developed as an engine for an aeroplane. Mm. But he went away in the meantime to Africa.
Yeah, he went from Sudan into what was then Abyssinia, now Ethiopia, to collect specimens, basically.
That's right, yes, yes. He was officially accredited by the National Museum in Paris, sending back specimens, and has travelled with porters, dined with the Emperor of Ethiopia.
Naturally, as you would.
And fell foul of him for shooting a couple of his elephants. I mean, his life is just full, absolutely chock full of extraordinary adventures, which he kind of tossed away as just c'est la vie or something like that.
Okay, now we're coming to the period, I suppose, where he begins to become more associated with aviation, and he returns to Paris in 1908 and is invited to learn to fly this monoplane, and the monoplane has this engine, this Antoinette engine that you were talking about. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, well, of course, they were terribly brave. They were fearless or foolhardy. They went up in these glorified
kites. Those magnificent
kites.
Men in their flying machines.
Exactly,
they went up
yes.
to the up-top. They and went down up, to the up-down.
They were made of canvas and almost string and sealing wax, but not quite. But certainly... one of his accidents was due to a fuel line that had been taped up with a bit of insulating tape. Now, could you imagine anyone going up in the air with something that stuck together with a piece of insulating tape?
Yeah,
anyway, but he took to it naturally. And of course, coming back to your cigarettes, he was the first man to put ashtrays right beside his controls in his aeroplane.
On one occasion, at least, when he had crash landed, he sort of bided time, waiting to be rescued by, you know, sort of smoking in the cockpit of the plane.
That's
basically.
Right. He put his feet up to keep them dry. He was landed in the English Channel and he lit a cigarette. Now, I mean, fire at sea. I mean, there was probably fuel all over the place, but, you know, sang froid.
And he actually has the distinction, does he not, of having completed the world's first landing of an aircraft in the sea. Now, I presume we're talking about a crash.
It was a crash. Yeah. I think that's a bit of a misdemeanor, right. You know. Yeah, he came down, he glided down, landed on the surface, and like that, just sat there waiting for them to pick him up.
Now, he made a couple of attempts to cross the channel. His next attempt was in July of 1909, but he was pipped at the post by the famous Louis Blériot, who was a name who would be far more familiar than Hubert Latham.
Yeah, and this is where we come into the interesting side to this story, because there were politics in the background and shenanigans going on, because Latham, with his German connection and his English and French, he wasn't fit for purpose, although he'd been puffed by Lord Northcliffe in the Daily Mail. He'd been made a hero. But then they discovered this sort of mixed ancestry and they decided, no, they wanted a full-blooded Frenchman, family man, solid sort of person to be honoured. And there were various strange things happened, even to the extent that when they didn't wake him to get up in time to fly, when he was ready, they wouldn't let him. They didn't want him to get any of the honour, which is rather strange. But none of this would be in the official record.
Was he the first man to fly a plane backwards?
He was blown backwards, I think, in Blackpool. But, I mean, there again, he flew in front of the Tsar's cousin and he was called Kingpin Man-Eagle in America. And at that time, they were practising war things. Now, he wasn't keen on the commercial aspects or the war effort, but they were certainly practicing dropping flower bombs down the funnels of battleships, and he stored a bullseye.
And he also used to do, I suppose you could call them stunts. He hunted wildfowl from an airplane to win a competition in Los Angeles. But also in 1910, he was offered $5,000 to fly over the city of Baltimore. What was that all about?
Well, that was a rather strange thing. There was an elderly gentleman in Baltimore who was a millionaire, and he had never seen an airplane, and before he died, he wanted to see one. He couldn't leave his sick room. So he said, would Latham like to fly over the city? Now, I think this was the first city ever in America that was flown by an aeroplane. So Latham obliged and circled around his house and the poor gentleman saw him fly.
As you say, he also mixed in interesting social circles. What was the relationship with Eileen Gray, with the famous furniture designer Eileen Gray?
Well, she certainly got to know him after the balloon flight we spoke about earlier. And she came to watch him fly the Channel, and she was on one of the boats that escorted him. And she was certainly a close friend. And then he went to the Orient afterwards in his travels. And I'd say he was tracking down Japanese artefacts. And, you know, he was very interested in art. I say one of his famous quotes was that there's no beautiful art in Abyssinia. He went to look for it, he couldn't find it. But he said it's the art of man that makes him superior to animals.
Now, tell me about his violent and untimely death. He was still a young man, he wasn't even in his 30s, in a remote outpost of the French colonial empire. What was he doing in Africa?
Yeah, that is really very eerie, and one of the reasons why he hasn't been remembered, I think. The company with the engine that he was flying went bankrupt in 1911, but in the meantime, he'd been asked by the French Colonial Office to go to the Congo on a mission of which it wasn't disclosed, and that all was always said. But I think he was investigating the radio telegraph system. They were trying to set up communications, and he'd the only way to travel that way was to go from Brazzaville by foot and canoe all the way up for months on end to reach Chad, where they wanted to set up a radio tent. But he had a lot of troubles. I was very fortunate that his original diary, handwritten in pencil in his little tent every night, I was given access to. And the stories in that would be quite extraordinary. I mean, the military were, it was a military zone.
Mm.
And he wasn't a bit pleased with what he found.
Now, the official record says killed by buffalo. You would perhaps dispute that.
Well, he went out to hunt a buffalo that night. He had wounded it. But his guns ended up, one of them ended up across the border. They went missing. I don't think when you put together the official report, it doesn't add up. And the man who translated the natives' account was a man he'd dismissed for stealing.
Do you think he was murdered?
I think he was murdered, and his family think he was murdered, but you won't find that in the official record, and that's the sad thing.
Why has he been forgotten?
Because Bleriot was the hero, the Wright brothers were the other heroes, and they have remained in the public mind, in popular culture, whereas a lot of others like Latham, but he had such an extraordinary mixture of interest and philosophies that I think he's worth remembering.
Barbara Walsh, thank you very much indeed for joining us and telling us about Hubert Latham, and Barbara's book, Hubert Latham, Forgotten Aviator, is published by Odyssey. He's there on the cover, complete with his signature cigarette in his mouth. And that's all we have time for this week. Check out our website for information and pictures relating to the items on this evening's programme. Join us next week when our offerings will include food and the First World War, as well as the centenary of Comin' the Mon. Until then, for me, Miles Duncan, and producer Yeti Redmond, goodbye and thanks for listening.